Blog Talk Radio.
Life is a song worth singing.
Why don't you
sing it? Life is a song worth singing.
Why don't you
sing it? You hold a key in the palm of your hand.
Use it.
Don't blame your life on a master plan.
Welcome, welcome to another exciting edition of Solar Now and the Future with its economic impact on Black America. And I'm your host, Ronald Bethay, and today's date is December the 16th in the year of 2020, a year that we will never forget. Ladies and gentlemen, if you join us on a regular basis, you know the slogan for this show is, there's power in numbers and the positive change purchasing cooperative captures that power for your financial benefit. The Positive Change Purchasing Cooperative is a blueprint for economic self-reliance for solar and renewable energy companies, both large and small, along with increasing market share for African-American-owned solar installation, design, workforce development, and training companies to address the effects of higher energy costs at our historically Black colleges and universities, to utilize Black-owned farmlands and HBCU campuses to develop capacity and initiatives for solar installation projects to bring down the underemployment of young African-American men and women locally and nationally, also to educate the Black community locally and nationally about the economic impacts of climate change and the need for environmental education in the Black community through Black Talk programs such as Solar Now and the Future with its economic impact on Black America. If you join us on a regular basis, you also know this program is brought to you every week by the Black Sports Legends Foundation, BSLF HBCU Solar Radio Talk Show Initiative. And you can get more information on that initiative by logging on to our website at www.positivechange, that's positivechangepc.com. Welcome, 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 ladies and gentlemen. We have a very, very, very exciting show for you today, ladies and gentlemen. We are blessed to have a very exciting guest to don our airways this morning, calling from the west coast of California, out of the Oak Town, the former town of the Oakland Raiders. I have a very, very dear friend there, Ray Chester, who played with the Oakland Raiders for many years, who happens to be an alumnus of my alma mater, Morgan State University. But so if you get an opportunity out on the West Coast, I know you're not listening this morning, Raymond, but hello. Ladies and gentlemen, we are blessed to have Mrs. Olivia Need, who is with Boat Solar's Public Policy and Access to Equity Program Director. Now, as we always like to say, for those who are in our listening audience, you know the call-in number is 646-668-2948. Once again, that call-in number is 646-668-2948. And please remember to press 1 on your phone pad after dialing the call-in number, because you're going to be in our green room and we want to bring you right on into our living room so we can have a very educational an exciting conversation with you, our listening audience, as we look at one of our organizations that has been waging, I call, a war in the area of public policy as it relates to trying to educate low and moderate income communities around this country about this new green economy and the things that drives the buck. It's called public policy. So without further ado, welcome, Olivia, to the airways of Solar Now in the Future with its economic impact on Black America.
Thank you so much, Ronald, for that introduction, and I'm really excited to be here, and I really look forward to chatting with you and sharing all of this great information with the audience.
Well, we're very, very pleased to have you. I had an opportunity. I was doing some research, and after doing the research, I was able to stumble onto a piece about Vote Solar and what your organization has been doing. So first, who is Vote Solar and how long have you been in existence and what is your mission?
Yes, so Vote Solar, we are a nonprofit policy advocacy organization, and our mission is to really make sure that solar is more accessible, it's more affordable for everyone across the United States. I've been at Vote Solar for about a year now. Previously, I was doing community organizing down in South Florida, and I joined Vote Solar because of this goal and this drive towards making access and equity center for everything that happens in terms of policy, regulatory work, engagement with partners. That's what really brought me to this organization. And when I think about three areas that Vote Solar really focuses on, we focus on massive consumer participation. And with that, we're talking about speeding up the transition to 100% clean energy. And this is going to require a shift both literally and figuratively. And from the centralized fossil, and the shift is going to have to happen from centralized fossil fuel, which is dominating our system right now. And this is something that's radical for utilities to think about, especially if we're talking about shifting power to Black communities and brown communities. So there's overwhelming support for solar. Consumer participation is really important. And we need to really think about who's having a disproportionate effect and impact in regards to solar. Another area of focus for Vote Solar is obviously access and equity. This is a commitment for us. And it's, like I said, it's something that brought me to this organization. And if we are still talking about making a clean energy, a 100% clean energy future, we have to stop and acknowledge the past harms and inequities that have happened. And if we don't do that, if we don't center and ground ourselves in systemic racism and how that has harmed Black people, we're not doing justice. We're not creating policies that are going to actually help people with their immediate needs. And so working on building a more inclusive path is something that we're really focused on, ensuring low wealth communities, Black communities, and all historically marginalized communities that they have opportunities, that they're sitting at the decision-making table, that they have ownership over these systems, and that they're building community wealth, and that they're getting access to those jobs that they actually do really need. And then a third area of focus for us is distributed energy resources. You know, we want to minimize costs, but we also need to maximize benefits. And those benefits need to go to those individuals who need it the most. And ensuring that distributed solar and other local clean energy resources like storage, energy efficiency, all those upgrades that folks need to see happen to their homes, and demand response, these things need to be valued. And they, again, need to be centered and focused in Black and brown communities and the needs that they have. So planning for, deploying, and operating all distributed energy resources to their full potential, this is something that's really fundamental to not only grid infrastructure, but also fundamental for Black communities.
Well, Olivia, now you would not know, but your DNA is very, very close to mine. And what I will say is this. When I had an opportunity, when I post your picture, I've made many trips to Orlando, Florida for the Florida Classic. And when I looked at your face, I said, well, she may be on the West Coast, but her DNA lies in the state of Florida because of the Seminole Nation. And I say that because little do people know about the true story about John Horace, who was the leader of the Seminole Nation that fought this country and dealt with leading the first original protest against racism as it relates to those Africans who escaped from the slave plantations in the Carolinas and Georgia, and they went into Florida because it was a Spanish domain. And just through the pure genetics, when I first traveled to Florida, I had never seen our African-American sisters with jet black straight hair that went all the way down to their heels. So I just want to mention that to you. I just want to throw that in as we begin to talk about the core issue, which is still race and racism in this country. And when we begin to talking about the word environmental racism, which was coined here in Washington, D.C., way back in the early 70s by a dear friend of mine who is no longer with us, Brother Nikiti, who started a movement around environmental racism. And many of the disparities in our communities as it relates to health, I first can testify to this issue because, unfortunately, my family, we lost a rising star who was my niece who suffered from asthma from the time Audra was a child. She was at her graduation party. She recently graduated about a year and a half ago from Bowie State University. She was actually at her graduation party dancing, had an asthma attack, and left us. See, these are the things when people get to talking about the issue of environmental racism and how it disproportionately affects our communities, but I can speak to how it rocked our family tree, and because Audra was a rising star. Everybody loved her. And to be at a funeral and to see over almost 2,000 young people who came to this biggest church that we could find in the D.C. metropolitan area, it said something about a young lady who, how she lived her life. But she suffered from one of those diseases, we call it a cancer, but it comes from environmental racism because as Mrs. Denise Fairchild, who has eloquently spoken, she has an organization called Emerald Cities. She's based out of Oakland, and she's in here, also has an office here in Washington, D.C., but she speaks about this, and she just spoke about this in a documentary that was put out by a gentleman by the name of Jonathan Scott. I don't know if you had an opportunity to see that documentary called Power Trip that spoke to the issues of how the utility companies are pushing back so hard against renewable energy and specific solar energy. And he started on this journey by just putting a PV system on his own roof. But I want to talk about the issue of public policy. Now, I know that you, in fact, and your organization has put together a equity advisory committee to sort of address, begin to sort of address this issue nationally. And as I strolled down through your website, I saw that a number of the issues that you are addressing are issues that heavily impact the Deep South, because the Deep South are all regulated markets. And for our listening audience, what that means is that by law, the utility companies in those market demographics have a legal monopoly. They control the generation of energy, the transmission of energy through the grid, the pricing of energy, and most of them have the public service commissions of those states in their back pockets because of the heavy influence that the fossil fuel industry has on lobbying the state legislatures as well as the public service commissions when these issues about passing net metering, renewable portfolio standards, and talking about community solar and then incentives in the market, and even renewing the grid. And I saw these are points that your organization has been dealing with. Now, I looked at it, and I saw that y'all are in, what, about 25 states now? How many states are y'all are located in? And could you talk about a little bit about the equity group that your organization has put together, and what are your goals and ambitions for this group?
Yeah, so overall, Vote Solar engaged in about 91 separate campaigns across the country, and these were either policy, legislative campaigns, the one like in Arizona to pass 100% clean energy, or work taking place in Illinois around CEJA, the Clean Energy Jobs Act. So Vote Solar is in about 22 states. We do a lot of regulatory work, working with the public utility commissions to make sure that they are keeping consumers in mind, that they're keeping everyday people in mind when they are making these regulations and they're making new rules. And so one of the things, you know, the advisory committee was really born and conceptualized out of two of our board members, Zeta Shai. He is the chairman and CEO of NextAmp, and our other board member, Rob Wallace, who is the co-founder and principal of Power 52 Energy Solutions. And so what they were seeing is we're doing all of this work, we're pushing for all this legislative and this regulatory work, but states for some reason just are not grasping what they need to be doing to help support communities on the ground. And so we're seeing as a result of, quite frankly, the state's lack of understanding how to meet the needs of folks, we're seeing low participation from communities. We're seeing Black and Brown communities again getting left behind. And, you know, these challenges need to be addressed. And so as states are creating low-income solar programs and they have all these carve-outs and these incentives, they really need to think about what are the challenges that folks are encountering every single day. That challenge of having to make the decision to pay for your groceries or your medicine over paying your electricity bill should not be a reality for any person in the United States. Yet it is, and that is a problem. And so the Access and Equity Advisory Committee was set up to really address those challenges. If we want Black people to have access to solar, have all the benefits of solar, we need to talk about how they should not have to make trade-offs every day so they can keep their lights on. We need to take time and address issues like financing to solar, the barriers with home ownership, the condition of homes for Black people, market forces, education and outreach. All of these things need to be discussed, and the states need to talk about them as they're implementing these programs. So I think you have all of these policy wonks out here who are doing a really good job of identifying those barriers like I just talked about. And you know, it's time for us to really stop talking about it and really do something. And so the Access and Equity Advisory Committee was designed to do just that. Myself, Vote Solar, and another colleague of mine, Brandy, we put together this committee, and we're taking a hard look at what are those real life problems that are stopping folks, particularly Black and Brown communities, from accessing solar. What needs to happen? And so, you know, the advisory committee is really focused and oriented on finding policies that are specifically addressing those everyday challenges that Black people have when looking to access solar.
Well, Olivia, one of the challenging parts about what the work you do, as I looked at the list of names of, and you mentioned Bob, I refer to him as Bob, Mr. Rob Wallace of Biff Energy, Baltimore, Maryland. I've had the privilege of having their former CEO, a very dynamic African-American sister, Coretta Bennett, who was their day-to-day operational manager. She also taught at the School of Engineering at my alma mater, which she's also a Morgan alumnus. Coretta has been on this platform numerous times talking about some of the same issues and challenges. Now, it's very ironic that Mr. Wallace just ran for mayor in Baltimore, Maryland, and he ran as an independent, and he lost that election because to a young African-American brother who was on the Democratic ticket. Now, I get into the politics on this to look at the two things that are very, very troubling to me on the Democrat and the Republican side, because we don't have to talk about COVID-45 in a few days. Administration will be one and done, but the impacts of the things that his administration has done over the past 4 years will be affecting this renewable energy industry and specifically solar industry for a long time to come. Now, as we began to delve down and look at the issue of advocacy and communication, I find that there's been slim left the building 6 months ago and none didn't show up for work. When it comes for looking at state legislatures putting money into Black talk or Black mainstream media, whether it be radio or printed, to educate the African-American community about this new green economy and the need to train our young people in workforce development training areas, in the area of becoming an electrician, to be able to do the wiring for EV infrastructure across this country, whether we're talking commercial or residential. When we look at the issue of training and workforce development programs, I happen to be wearing two hats. I'm also the founder of the Positive Change Purchasing Cooperative, but I've also been elected recently to serve as the president of the National Association of Blacks in Solar. We trade as Blacks in Solar. And our goal right now is, we're working very, very feverishly, is to have congressional hearings concerning many of the issues that you've already spoken so eloquently to, concerning the African-American communities. Because when we look at this solar industry and we look at the data put out by the Solar Foundation, which takes your and my tax dollars to sort of crank the numbers to look at the issue of diversity in this solar industry, we are non-existent, and nobody wants to address this. And when we began to talk about the number of African-American companies doing business in the U.S., out of 9,000 companies doing business in the United States, we have less than 25 African-American solar installation design workforce development companies that I can identify. And when you add on top of that the impact of even in deregulated markets, which I reside in the PJM region, I had the privilege of being at a policy information summit put on at the University of Maryland here in College Park, here in College Park, Maryland, put on by the Maryland Clean Energy Center out of Annapolis, Maryland. And I went to a workshop on workforce development, and I had the privilege of speaking to Mrs. Sherry Brooks, who heads the Power 52 Workforce Development Training Initiative, working with Mr. Rob Wallace's firm out of Baltimore, Ray Lewis, who fell a Hall of Famer with the great with the Baltimore Ravens, and Mr. Wallace and Sherry Brooks have put together this workforce development training program, and it absolutely incensed me as I talked with Sherry and looked at the challenges that she has in terms of getting funding. So when I spoke with the Assistant Secretary for the State of Maryland, Mr. James Rakowski, concerning how much funding coming from the Department of Energy for workforce development training in the state of Maryland. The state of Maryland has 23 counties. Mr. Rakowski said to me, he said, "Buffay, I would love to come on your podcast and share information, but Governor Hogan would fire me." He said, "But let me tell you something. I'm going to give you some information that you can share with your listening audience." He says, as of July 1, when our fiscal year comes in the year 2020, the state of Maryland will receive $110 million for workforce development training. He said, but the state only legislature in Annapolis only program $8 million for workforce development training. He said, look, man, I got 23 counties in the state. He said, you can go to Indeed, job, online, format, jobs to careers, put in solar energy, and put your zip code in, and you'll see all of these jobs that we have in the state of Maryland, and you don't need a four-year degree for these many of these positions. He said, but hell, the state of Maryland didn't even tell us, we are the Department of Labor, how we could spend that money. I only have two pilot programs in the whole state of Maryland to train young people to become solar installers, energy auditors. We need it all. I heard Senator Cyburns from the state of Maryland speak at that event. He said, look, over the next 15 years, the state of Maryland will spend $27 billion to combat the rise of the sea level, because if we don't, downtown Baltimore will be underwater, as well as our capital, Annapolis. So he said, we're fortunate that the Naval Academy is there, because you're going to need a ship if we don't address it. So with all of these things going on, looking at the Biden's administration, which has come is because of our vote, and I look at the person who I felt very, very strongly should have been given He's MSNBC commentator. He started the group Green for All on the West Coast. I think of your brother's name. He's an attorney. He authored the Green Jobs Act. But it only came about because Katrina hit New Orleans and how Bush's administration bundled handling that disaster that Van Jones, who opted that, got Congress to codify the Green Jobs Act. And if anybody knows anything about the solar industry, solar is not new. It's been around since the space age. It's over almost 60 years old, but it didn't take off until our communities went to the polls in untold numbers and elected Barack Hussein Obama, and he initiated the Sunshine Identity Initiative, which was the biggest thing that his administration did. It was not Obamacare. He tied it into the Naval Department, Defense Department, and California, they developed the largest large-scale solar power farm in the history of this country, which gave rise to the development of billions of dollars in federal loan guarantees, which gave this solar industry the impetus to take off, because you had the private entities and interests from the stock market who poured billions of dollars, private investment dollars, into building large-scale solar farms, but little or no attention has been paid to commercial pace as it relates to that spreading across the country, and residential pace programs. And for our listening audience, the PACE program is something that's been passed by Congress, which looks at renewable upgrades the same way as sewer and water, public benefits, and it was a 30% investment tax credit. But with all this information being out here, little or no information has filtered down to our community. That is the reason why I set up this platform. So I wanted to sort of throw all these other things into the mix of the conversation today, because these issues are not discussed. And one of the things that's troubling to me, Biden's administration is going to has already pledged to spend $1.7 trillion to address climate change, but where is and who's calling for a green economic development plan for Black America but the National Association of Blacks and Solar? So I want to make sure that our listening audience is aware that they can get more information about that by logging on to our website at positivechangepc.com. And we must prepare our young people for this. And without advocacy organizations such as Vote Solar driving home these issues, so type of funding assistance has come forth to help you sort of mainstream the messages that y'all are trying to get out, Olivia?
Well, I think funding is very hard to come by. And so in order to get our message out, we really had to connect and partner up with grassroots organizations and EJ groups. And without them and their knowledge on the ground, it makes it difficult for us to do our work, because we don't know, we don't have that direct touch. And so thinking about funding is so fundamental to Black communities. When you look at systemic racism and how for decades Black people have been excluded from accessing wealth, and that translates into ownership of businesses and jobs and owning more than what you're just given, we need to really take a step back and talk to the federal government and our states about what is your hesitation with providing adequate and enough funding to rectify the past harms that you created and caused for Black people. And until that happens, until we really put the pressure on to see increased funding through programs for individuals like LIHEAP and WAP, weather assistance programs, until we see increases in funding for those things for individuals, how are we really going to make folks' lives better? And then when you turn and you look at the business side of it, and we're talking about workforce development, that means economic growth. That means economic wealth for Black communities. And if we aren't thinking and talking strategically about how are we building those pipelines for communities, how are we making sure that we're attracting folks? And like you said, getting that information to communities, it's not happening. And the reason I think it's not happening is because folks are just afraid. When you see people in this policy, in this technical space, and it is time for them to talk about the issues of race, you see a lot of hesitation. You see a lot of fear. And that fear and hesitation is going to do nothing for Black communities who are looking for jobs and economic growth and wealth, the same as their white counterparts. We need to stop with this fear, and we need to turn that into action. And that, like you said, that is that funding piece. That underfunding of our communities has pushed us and left us back, that we are still and we will continue to fight to get ahead until they acknowledge that it's time. We need to give funding to those communities that need it. We need to stop being hesitating about how much funding, and we just need to do it.
Well, one of the things that I try to do with this platform, I hope you've had an opportunity to sort of go through our news and events section under in our blog, is to load different types of articles as it relates to verifying and providing data that supports the position that we both have taken, because you sound like the young man said, when you go to the church, it's like the head deacon is talking to the Pope. It's a circular conversation that we agree upon by 1,000,000,000%, not 1,000,000, but 1,000,000,000%. And this has been the problem that I've had when I've spoken at events put on by nonprofit organizations that are run by folks who don't look like me and you. And I have a bad habit of making folks uncomfortable in those spaces, because I speak truth to power about there is no equity in the solar industry. And I base that on data put out by the Solar Foundation. And even when I've gone to policy summits here in Washington, D.C., put on by the American Association of Blacks in Energy, and I don't knock anybody because I understand people will not, and they're not going to cut off the hand that feeds them. But when your funding is coming from the utility and fuel interest groups, and you're talking about representing Black folks in this space, it's a no-go, because you can't bring and just put Black faces in high places and think that that's going to make a change. That's not going to get it done. And I ask questions that I know the answers to here. And for example, AIDE had a policy summit on the 8th and 9th of this year. It was virtual. Well, I called Tracy Woods, who's the day-to-day operational manager. I said, well, Tracy, you know I'm pressed, and I would like cover your event to see what's being said. But I've been to a number of their summits before we got hit by this plandemic. I don't call it a pandemic. I call it a plandemic. And this is even seeped in racism. So the issue of addressing, if you're going to bring CEOs, and I call them HINCs, short for Head Us in Charge, who are those who may be of my age group, because I am a baby boomer. That means we came through the door in the 69, 70, 71s, and some of them are still there. If they haven't retired, well, they've reached the glass ceiling if they aren't gone already. And I started questioning, why would you have a policy summit? And we've got Howard University, University of District of Columbia, Bowie State, Morgan State, Coppin State, Georgetown, AU, University of Maryland. I said, with all of these colleges and universities right here in the Washington, Baltimore metropolitan area, you don't have any young African-American business students here. We don't have any students that we could have gotten to come in and hear what's being discussed in this arena. This is unconscionable. So I made Abigail Copper very, very busy, very, very not busy, but uncomfortable, who Abigail Harper, she has the Solar Industry Trade Association, because I talked about the lack of diversity in the solar industry, but you also have the same problems across the whole energy industry, whether it be fossil fuel or renewables. Our communities have never received their fair share, but within a 70-mile or 35-mile radius of any communities of color, and specifically African-American communities, you've got one of these coal-burning acceleration plants spewing out these carcinogens in the air that are the reasons why, other than transportation and the cows that's on the planet, because they got to go to the bathroom too, spitting these the emissions into the atmosphere, that's causing something called global warming. I said, now, if we don't get our young people programmed to talk about and deal with these issues, when you look at our historical HBCUs, none of them have offices of sustainability. I have had the privilege of working with Dr. Lilia Abrams. She is one of our leading environmental engineers. She was the first black woman to get a PhD in environmental engineering and started her firm here in Washington, D.C. in 1978 with two employees. She now has five offices nationally and two offices internationally before this pandemic hit. And she has done a standing job in putting together a HBCU five-year green sustainability plan that we have gone into the Department of Commerce to try to get funding to try to address many of these disparities that exist in our communities, because when you go to the communities where historically black colleges and universities are located, there is what they call enterprise zones. In other words, it looked like Beirut after it was bombed. So we cannot sit silently and think that systemic and institutional racism is going to change itself. I loaded an article that spoke to the issue about student debt and how it's linked to wealth building in this country. It is on our website. People can go to our news and events tab, and it was put out by the Century Foundation in 2019. If you do the reading, the research is there. It will absolutely blow your mind when it talks about the fact that Brown versus the Board of Education in 1954, it took them to 1980 to really try to implement any change in the actual integration of the public school systems in the United States of America, K through 12, kindergarten through 12. And someone came up with a bright idea called charter schools. By 1989, the school system, public school system districts are resegregated. The white school districts in this, according to this study put out by the Century Foundation, received $23 billion more for funding white school districts compared to black school districts. There cannot be, there's no way that the kids can be getting the same education when you don't have the same funding, but that comes from our public dollars. When you take these issues and you back it up with data and you put it in front of our elected officials, only a few will stand up. And this is something that can be changed if we educate our young. I'm a grandfather now, so you got the millennials, then you got the what, the Z population, the young kids that are coming. We have to focus on educating our young people. I've had the privilege of having a gentleman out of your state capital. He has a charter school called Green Tech, where they've been training young people how to become energy advisors, installers, things like these type of programs. And these type of charter schools need to be put on steroids. We beat the drum on this for 4 years. We bust the cover about 99 times. We will continue to beat the drum concerning these issues because, as you have so elegantly stated, Olivia, no one wants to talk about these issues at these forums. I get more emails inviting me to come to the Pace Nation group, to come to this group, to come to this forum, go to that forum. But when I invite people onto this platform to say, well, let's talk about the underlying 2,000-pound King Kong in the room, which is institutional systemic racism as it relates to the fact that the energy industry and utility industry, which we as consumers, when you pay your electric bill, we are subsidizing these monopolies, which was laid out very elegantly by Jonathan Scott in a recent documentary, which I recommend strongly that everyone go to PBS in their local market and look at that documentary. It laying out who controls what and who owns what, and you'll see the same suspects, the Koch brothers, these billionaires. They are the ones who control this game, but we have to educate our young people around these issues because our very lives depend upon this. This is not a game, ladies and gentlemen. Now, if anyone wants to weigh in, you know the calling number is 646-668-2948. That's 646-668-2948. Olivia, we're going to take a slight pause for the calls here on Solar Now in the Future with its economic impact on Black America, and we're going to be right back as we delve into some other issues that I'm going to get this brilliant, beautiful sister, intelligent sister, to talk about these issues because they certainly aren't addressed enough on any national platforms, and that is why we have created this platform called Solar Now and the Future with its economic impact on Black America. We're going to take a slight pause for the
someone singing, I can just sing it. Life is a song worth singing. Why don't you sing it? You hold the key in the palm of your hand. Use it. Don't blame your life on a master plan. Change it. Only you generate the power to decide what to do with your life. You're a fool if you think you're helpless. You control what you do with your life.
Welcome, 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 ladies and gentlemen, back to the airways of Solar Now and the Future with its economic impact on Black America. And I'm very, very pleased to have Mrs. Olivia Need, who is the policy director of Vote Solar Access and Equity Program based out of Oakland, California. Now, Olivia, your organization is a policy organization. So I want to know, what has Vote Solar, what role have you played in working to address renewable portfolio standards policy in regulated markets, which in the south, in southeastern and southern states of the U.S., because, I mean, it's a war, it's a silent war going on in Virginia. Just passed renewable portfolio standard legislation. The state of North Carolina has a piece of legislation now in their state house. South Carolina, my home state where I hail from, has legislation. Georgia has legislation. The state of Florida has legislation. So what roles is your organization playing in any of these states in addressing this issue? And the reason why I'm raising this question is because I have one of our charter founding members, a gentleman by the name of Mr. Will Shirley, who's the only African-American who owns a solar installation and a design company in Mississippi. He's based out of Jackson, Mississippi. And I've been working with him concerning putting together some programs and projects to address many of the issues. And in January, he will be in front of the state legislature in Mississippi to talk about some of the same issues that we are raising over this platform today. So what is Vote Solar doing to address policy issues in some of our southern states? If you could address that.
Yeah, and, you know, the Southeast is one of my favorite places. My family lives in Florida, so it's a state near and dear to my heart. But I think when we talk about renewable portfolio standards, this is that regulatory mandate that we and states need to increase the production of energy resources, of clean energy resources like wind and solar. But in order to this is driving it, and it's also happening incrementally. What Vote Solar is doing is we have a Southeast regulatory team. It's a team of really awesome folks who are deep diving into the needs of Florida, South Carolina, Georgia, Virginia, and they're really attacking at the regulatory level. So, for example, recently in Florida, there was an attack that was starting up on net metering, and it was this idea that a representative had gotten that net metering is causing cost shifts, it's putting a burden on folks, but also this idea that he had that we're scamming people. It was just the weirdest thing you could ever hear, that he felt like low-income customers were being scammed and convinced into accessing solar, and therefore we need to stop net metering. And what happened was we banded together. Volt Solar banded an arm in arm with our partners on the ground, EJ Group, grassroots group, and we said, no, hold on, put a pause. And what we have to stop and realize is all of this is happening, like you said, because you have some dark money flowing into this state. You have utilities and these big businesses that think and they have the means to control how outcomes happen. And so what happened in the case of Florida, over, I think it was something like 16,000 comments were sent to the PUC asking them, hey, this is not the time to talk about net metering. And so we were able to put a pause on it, but that doesn't mean that dark money and big business isn't going to pop up again and try to attack net metering in Florida. Taking away net metering now, when Black and brown people have not even had the chance to fully access and use the benefits of it, it's just, again, perpetuating systemic racism. You are stopping folks from accessing something that they didn't even get the chance to touch yet. And so I think looking at Florida, I'm on the same page with you, is there is some bad actors. There are some folks out there who do not have Black communities in mind. And the way that they are operating, the way that they are moving, it is to keep us disenfranchised and have no access. Because the moment we have access to solar, that means we now can sustain on our own. We don't need to pay the utility company a bill anymore. FPL benefits when we have to pay them. When we are in arrears to FPL and we are indebted to them, they don't care. Because look, they're still trying to do things like shutting off our electricity in a time of COVID, which is just absolutely ridiculous. So I think, you know, we really need to put a pause and really call out these large companies that are doing wrong by our communities and that are intentionally, and I say intentionally because you can't tell me in the 21st century that these companies don't know what they're doing, that they don't know who they're targeting and who they're impacting and who they plan to harm, because it is very evident who in this country receives all the benefits and who doesn't. And so in the Southeast, it's a very big area for us. We are working hard, but the challenges that we are met with is the deep pockets of these big corporations and these big utilities who just are not interested in seeing any of these clean energy benefits flowing to low-income communities. And then when you stop go ahead, yeah.
Yeah, well, Reverend Johnson out of Greensboro, North Carolina, he was in the documentary that I mentioned that Jonathan Scott has produced called Power Trip. And I've been aware of the fight in North Carolina for quite some time and Reverend Johnson, because he is an old warrior. And his church, in fact, became sort of like a test case that was a group out of Warren County, an advocacy group, sort of put together, so they put PV systems on his visiting center at his church there in Greensboro. And this case went all the way to the Supreme Court within 1 year in North Carolina. And, of course, the Supreme Court ruled against them, and they had to pay back the monies that they – because they were able to provide those green kilowatts at a cheaper rate to the congregation of members. I know you can hear – you can hear that we don't have much time left here on this hour, and it's going back by so quickly. But I want to put a sort of pin in this. I've got to have you back, Olivia, on this platform in the very near future so we can delve into some of these issues, because I programmed 90 minutes, but I didn't know what your schedule was, and that's why I put an hour in and not an hour and a half, because we could talk for days about these issues because they have to be addressed. But is there anything you would like to say to our listening audience before we close this program today?
The only thing I want to leave off saying is I had the opportunity to attend Howard University School of Law, and I saw how important it is not only to have that education and that perspective of equity and access built into your education, but how we need to have funding for HBCUs at every level so more people who look like me can be talking about these issues, can be advocating for Black communities, because I'm not the first and I'm not the last, but we need a lot more people in this space if we want to see real change.
Well, Olivia, I know your face looked familiar. My wife just retired from Howard University about 4 years ago. She ran the graduate, she was head of publications at the graduate school. She worked at Howard for 45 years. She got an undergraduate degree from Howard. She got a PhD from Howard, got a master's from AU. So I've been around Howard's campus. So I've seen your face on campus. I didn't know who you were. But
seen
I know
each other,
you look
yeah.
me. Because I've been on Howard's campus. My daughter just recently, 3 years ago, graduated from undergraduate there. So as you said, we lost a true champion recently, Dr. Gary Harris. He passed on. He was the dean of the School of Engineering and a champion there, a true champion there, and a very close friend of mine. So I wanted to acknowledge him again. He just recently passed. You have been a breath of fresh air. I really appreciate you taking time from your busy schedule to join us here on this platform, Solar Now and the Future with its economic impact on Black America. And you will not be a stranger to this platform, because we will be reaching out to you. And I hope that I can work with your organization in the future and we can get some things done through Congress here legislatively, because we're going to have to demand that our state legislatures, as well as our congressional Black members of our Congressional Black Caucus that play key roles, such as Donald McGeechan, who's chair of the Environmental Sustainability Whip for the Congressional Black Caucus, have congressional hearings on these issues. And that's what the National Association of Blacks and Solar, we're working on and calling for right now. So thank you once again for taking time from your very busy schedule to be a guest here on Solar Now in the Future with its economic impact on Black America. With that, we'll be ending our show. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes another exciting edition of Solar Now in the Future with its economic impact on Black America. Until next week, we don't want you to meet us here. We want you to be this here. Until next week, we say go in peace.